Greetings and welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. We're talking about religion and pop culture. Sometimes the two, when you talk about it, end up sounding like exactly the same thing. Terry Mattingly is our guest. We invite your questions and your comments as well. Our call-in number, 1-800-730-2727, 1-800-730-2727, or our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Terry is the author of the nationally syndicated On Religion column for Scripps Howard News Service. He's director of the Washington Journalism Center at the Council for Christian Colleges and Universities, and he's author of the new book, Pop Goes Religion, Faith, and Pop Culture. We'll be giving that book away, 1-800-730-2727, or issuesetc@kfuo.org. Terry, welcome back.
Okay.
Folks, we're going to get back to your phone calls and your email in just a moment. Terry, a pressing question left over from the last hour on two pop American icons. I'm thinking about Johnny Cash and Elvis Presley. Of course, Johnny Cash has been the subject of this movie, Walk the Line, most recently. But these are two guys, in addition to being unbelievable artists of their time and kind of icons of their time, they also had a very tense relationship with their Christian faith. Talk about them, if you would.
Well, Elvis was seen to be your classic, you know, young man who had a fairly conservative, walk the aisle, make a profession of faith childhood, and then got lost along the way. I mean, and literally, at one point or another in his life, tried everything in the way of religious seeking or searching. On hyperdrive, I think I put it at one point. Cash was a deeply flawed and struggling man. By the way, he's the Christian artist that I think more than any other, I think Bono of U2 would identify with. The two of them were good friends. But Cash also, of course, was very close to Billy Graham. And in the midst of his struggles, Cash was a very articulately mainstream evangelical Christian. The movie, Walk the Line, includes, if you look at the time frame covered in the movie, it includes the really most overt and striking moment of Johnny Cash's Christian turning back to the Christian life, which was when he attempted to commit suicide by crawling off literally into a cave to die. And in the midst of that, felt he had a renewed sense of Christ's presence in his life and decided he must live. And that, for some reason, didn't seem to end up in the movie. But the thing about Johnny Cash, to me, is you often hear people say that, you know, that Christian faith is a real artistic problem, that it's impossible to be very successful in mainstream music if you're going to be very overt about your faith. Well, gosh, it's kind of hard to make that case if you're looking at Johnny Cash, isn't it?
One thing that strikes me about both Elvis and Cash is at the heights of their careers, they would go off and record what is essentially gospel albums.
Well, and, you know, Alan Jackson has just released a gospel album. In country music, and there's a section of my book about this, country music has always had this tradition that you are allowed to sing about Sunday morning as well as Saturday night. And I once had a chance to ask Naomi Judd about this, and Judd made a very interesting point, which is that one of the staples of country music is the cheating song. You know, she done cheat on me. She ripped out my heart and stomped that sucker flat, to use the classic paraphrase. But Judd's point was very interesting, which is that to do a cheating song, that implies that there is something to cheat against. And that in much of country music, it is American popular culture's music that most accepts the fact that there are some eternal truths, and that thus you can sin by violating them. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
You don't see a lot of cheating songs on MTV, do you?
Well, not put that way. The other thing that strikes me about country music, and I think this is brought out, I think you even quote Veith's book, Honky Tonk Gospel.
Right.
In yours, Pop Goes Religion. Veith says that country music is more than any other popular American music about real lives, not about the life lived with the bling bling and the limousines. Even though the people who make the music have all that stuff, their songs are still about you and me living in middle America or wherever we live with our wife and our kids and usually the dog.
Right.
Seems that's missing from a lot of Christian, at least pop American Christian preaching. What I get from pop American Christian preaching is not the real life, but the ideal life.
Well, they're scared to talk a lot about failure. I think one of the most interesting quotes in my book is in the section on movies where I interviewed Robert Duvall, the great Academy Award-winning actor. And Duvall is not a believer. He's a man that I would consider intensely God-haunted. And I think he would even say that himself. But Duvall is fascinated with the fact that Christians make such lousy movies. And he says, I can understand that Hollywood has trouble dealing with sin, admitting that sin exists. But why do Christians have trouble dealing with sin?
And he's speaking, he's speaking as an unbeliever.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the Left Behind series. I don't know.
Must we?
Yeah, we really do.
Okay.
At least in terms of the amount of money made in the number of books sold, it qualifies as a major milestone in American pop culture one way or the other. And it certainly crossed from kind of niche thief in the night film type of stuff into popular culture. Your thoughts on the Left Behind series?
Well, I don't consider myself an expert on them at all, and I have not read them. There was a moment a couple of years ago. Do you remember when the Left Behind guys ended up on the cover of, I think it was Newsweek?
Mm-hmm.
And I was struck by the fact that in that same issue of Newsweek, when it was talking about, you know, Left Behind and how powerful this was and all the people who'd bought the book, there was another article in the same issue of Newsweek that was talking about what the authors called the will and grace effect, which was that people who do not normally believe in gay rights, if they watch the show Will and Grace enough, you can trace their changing moral and political beliefs on that issue because of their exposure over time to that show. Isn't that interesting? Well, what struck me was the fact that there are probably a lot more young evangelical Christian high school students and college students watching Will and Grace than there are young gay and lesbian high school students and college students who are reading Left Behind books. To some degree, Left Behind is another example of Christians preaching to the choir, while Hollywood is probably doing a better job of evangelizing our own children, in large part because we let that happen.
Many Christians would cheer at the success of the Left Behind series. Some would even call it a coup d'etat into the culture. Here it is, just selling right off of the bookshelves of Barnes & Noble and Walden Books and all the others. What do you think, Terry, 30 seconds before our break?
I just said I don't think it's that big of a breakthrough. There have been Christian bestsellers through the years. The rise of Walmart and a lot of other places that track the sales of Christian products have just made it easier for us to see, you know, what's been true for several generations, which is that Christian books and Christian music sell a lot. But selling a lot is not necessarily the same as reaching people who don't already believe.
Terry Mattingly is our guest. We're talking about religion and pop culture tonight on Issues Etc. Feel free to join us. We're coming to you live this Sunday. It's the 19th of March. 1-800-730-2727. 1-800-730-2727. Our in-studio email address is issuesetc@kfuo.org. This break is a great time to call. 1-800-730-2727. Terry writes the On Religion column for Scripps Howard News Service, and he's author of the book Pop Goes Religion, Faith in Popular Culture. We'll be giving that book away to our best callers and emailers right after this.
We give thanks for the folks at LCMS World Relief because they are the hands and the feet that allow many people to reach out in charity and love to those who are less fortunate than we.
Issues Etc. regular guest Dr. Arthur Just on the importance of LCMS World Relief.
In the Gospels, Jesus says that he came not to be served, but to serve and give his life as a ransom for many. And spending out his life for us on the cross is how he served us. Because Christ is in us, and we embody him in his mercy and love, we are to manifest that in our lives. And LCMS World Relief does exactly that by reaching out with concrete expressions of Christ's love, mercy, and compassion to those who have been broken by storm and tempest, who, for whatever reason, need the kind of love and compassion that is in us because Christ is in us.
For more information or to donate to LCMS World Relief, call them toll-free 1-888-930-4438.
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Dr. John Warwick Montgomery, Craig Parton, Dr. Gary Habermas, and I invite you to attend the 10th Annual European Summer Study of the International Academy of Apologetics, Evangelism, and Human Rights. The Academy will be held July the 11th through the 22nd next summer in Strasbourg, France. For more information, check out the What's New section of our website, issuesetc.org, or call our resource line number 1-800-737-0172, and we'll send you a free brochure, 1-800-737-0172. Improve your abilities to defend the faith and teach the truth by attending the International Academy of Apologetics, Evangelism, and Human Rights, July the 11th through the 22nd in Strasbourg, France. For more information, call our resource line, 1-800-737-0172 or issuesetc.org. We hope to see you there. Welcome back to Issues Etc. We're talking with Terry Mattingly of Scripps Howard News Service, author of the book Pop Goes Religion, about religion and pop culture. Our call-in number is 1-800-730-2727, or our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Terry, we've talked about several movies here, but one that needs to be mentioned, also one that at least the hopes from the fans of its original author, J.R.R. Tolkien, hoped for his explicitly Christian worldview to come through in the Lord of the Rings trilogy. You've written that you got to know what to look for if you're going to watch these movies and get Tolkien's view of the world. What do you mean?
Well, that was true also of the books, though. Tolkien did not think he was writing explicitly Christian parables or myths. He thought he was writing one that had a lot of his Catholic worldview absorbed into it. I thought it was very interesting that the people at the heart of the movie project, which would be Philippa Boyens, the main screenwriter, and Peter Jackson, for example, they said, Fran Walsh, the other writer, of course, and Jackson's common-law wife, all three of them told the press during the press events for the films that they did not want to make a religious movie. Yet at the same time, they were very aware of the Christian underpinnings of much of what Tolkien did, and they didn't want to strip that out of the films, which I think, frankly, I was surprised. I liked parts of the movies better than others, but when you consider that nobody involved in the project was at the top level were Christians or traditional believers in any way, I thought they did an amazing job of leaving the basic worldview of Tolkien intact.
One of the things I wondered about when the film was being made, knowing the same thing there that you have just mentioned, not really having Christian believers working on the film at the top levels, what I wondered kind of cynically at the time was, I don't even know if I would want someone, an earnest Christian, working at the top levels there. I would, I'm afraid the movie might become a little preachy.
Well, yeah, or even, exactly right. Preachy's a great word. I was afraid that we would end up with a lot of kind of semi-spiritual, kind of nature-worshipping, you know, painting with the colors, the wind, Disney-esque, Pocahontas meets whatever, Gaia worship or something, to do a thoroughly stream-of-conscious series of images there. But you could make a case that, you know, that a Christian that got their hands on this, first of all, I mean, name me an A-list Christian writer, director, producer, other than perhaps Mel Gibson. And who, oh, good Lord, how bloody would the battle scenes of Lord of the Rings have been if Mel Gibson had got his hands on it?
It would have been longer, too, yes.
Well, I don't think it could have got much longer. You're saying the battle scenes would have been longer.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. I joked around on the blog, getreligion.org, that I think that the next Mel Gibson biblical project has got to be Samson. Don't you think Samson has got everything in it Mel Gibson could possibly want in a movie?
Absolutely. Actually, it would make a great movie. I just don't know if Mel Gibson should be making it.
Name me someone better.
What about The Chronicles of Narnia? This was another one of those films that, like The Passion of the Christ, pre-release, didn't have the controversy attached to it, but had the same kind of in-house enthusiasm from American evangelicals based on C.S. Lewis's series of novels?
Well, you know, it obviously had the built-in Narnia audience. People keep talking about, you know, The Chronicles of Narnia making a comeback. You know, what kind of comeback are you talking about when the books have been selling a million volumes a year every year, you know, every year since they came out? I mean, what's to come back from? So Narnia, if unless you just really messed it up, Narnia was a can't miss, you know, economic proposition, especially when you consider that digital effects make it possible to pretty much do the book straight. I thought the first Narnia movie was pretty much just a solid B or a B+. And dear friend of mine and the wife of the priest at my parish, Frederica Matthews Green of BeliefNet.com and National Public Radio, and a lot of other places, Frederica made what I thought was a perfectly apt observation, and that was all of the best parts of the movie, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, were the parts that were closest to the book, and all of the weakest parts of the movie were the parts that were furthest from the book, or the things they kind of added in for the sake of what they thought were youth viewer-friendly action scenes. But still, you know, I was basically pleased with it, and I thought moments of it, the movie, were breathtaking.
Our call-in number, 1-800-730-2727, 1-800-730-2727. Let's start out with Norm, who listens on KLCV in Lincoln, Nebraska. Norm, welcome to Issues, Etc.
I think some of these things go in fads. Weren't the chorales and cantata things 250 years ago, weren't they pop culture?
So you're talking about the music of the
music
culture
partly,
versus...
Yeah, and then they had the publishing companies to put those things out. Then 150 years ago, we had American gospel songs that had a verse with refrain. And these things bother me, too, because one man said, you know, we ought to have disposable publications where, you know, the popular hit on K-Love Radio or something might be popular for a few months, then... So let's don't put them in a hard book. Let's put them out in a little paperback book and disposables, because they're going to be gone in a little while.
Norman, thank you very much for the call and listening out there in Lincoln, Nebraska. He goes back to that subject of the movement of music
yeah.
from the pop culture into the church, and then the transience, I think you mentioned that before, the transience of that kind of music. Terry?
Well, he's got an excellent point there. And one of the things you need to understand, though, is that all of this is picking up speed and momentum. Where, you know, like I said, I'm a convert to Eastern Orthodoxy, and in my church, musical trends are literally measured in the centuries. We sing music at my parish all the time that are hundreds or more than 1,000 years old. Now, in Protestantism, you don't have that. Now, obviously, in the hymns of Wesley or the hymns of Luther, you have stuff that are a couple of centuries old, yet still play major roles in those traditions. If you looked at the Southern Baptist tradition, the Southern Baptist Convention, a part of the Free Church Protestant movement in which changes occur the fastest, it is true that there are a lot of gospel songs that ended up in the hymnal, and that could be considered an example of popular music becoming hymnody. At the same time, though, the Southern Baptists lived with the same hymnals for generations. The same hymnal would sit, you know, in the pews, which meant you at least had some sense of continuity between people ranging from like 60 years of age to the, you know, to teenagers, you know, for several decades. If I could tell a personal story, which I think a lot of your listeners might identify with.
Terry, I'm going to ask you to hold that for the other side of the break. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, I do want to hear that story as we pick up on the subject of music in pop culture and in the church. Terry Mattingly is our guest. Norm, if you would, stay on hold. I'm going to send you a copy of Terry's book called Pop Goes Religion, Faith in Popular Culture. Terry Mattingly is also author of the nationally syndicated On Religion column for Scripps Howard News Service, director of the Washington Journalism Center at the Council for Christian Colleges and Universities. Our call-in number 1-800-730-2727, 1-800-730-2727. We'll continue our conversation with Terry on pop culture and religion. On the other side of this break, we'll also be taking your questions and your comments via the telephone and the email 1-800-730-2727 or issuesetc@kfuo.org. If you're like me, you could spend hours just browsing in a bookstore. Well, every month we tell our Issues Etc. listeners about a special book. We call it the Issues Etc. Book of the Month. And you can find each and every one of our Issues Etc. Books of the Month at Concordia Publishing House's bookstores. They're here in St. Louis. One's at 3558 South Jefferson in the city, the other on the campus of Concordia Seminary here in Clayton. They're signs for the CPH bookstore. They have the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for March. It's called He Is Risen Indeed. It's a children's book telling the simple story of Christ's death and resurrection. These are the CPH bookstores, 3558 South Jefferson, or here on the campus of Concordia Seminary in Clayton. The Book of the Month for March, He Is Risen Indeed, 3558 South Jefferson, or on the campus of Concordia Seminary.
The radio voice of the Lutheran faith for the 21st century. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Todd Wilkin here again, talking with David Erickson, illustrator of our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for March. He Is Risen Indeed. It's a children's book. David, how do you illustrate a children's book that begins with Jesus' death?
I went literal. I just basically thought, where are they? Well, I think... from what I understand, they must have been in or near a quarry, and that provided for me kind of a good metaphor for the rest of the book. The illustrations in the first half of the book or so are cold and cool-colored and not a lot of vegetation. And as we move toward Mary Magdalene meeting with Jesus a little bit later on in the book, everything changes. The colors are warmed. We have vegetation all around. It's just it provided for me, even though it was all literally conceived in my mind, it provided for me a very good metaphor or narrative tool to move throughout the story. You know, things are cold and dark and gloomy at first, and then when Jesus appears to Mary Magdalene, everything changes.
Okay, so talk about that resurrection scene.
I did do a little bit. I stuck a little bit with traditional approach. He's sort of in the light garment. He's not. But on the other hand, it looks like he's in sort of the sort of clothing that a guy in that time period would also work in. His sleeves are a little bit pulled up, and that's kind of how I like to think about Jesus as you know, he's always working for me. He's always at work for me, and a good way for me to convey that visually is to have his sleeves be kind of rolled up.
Finally, David, you know the tendency in children's books is to sugarcoat the Bible stories, even the stories of Jesus' death and resurrection. So how do you avoid that as an illustrator?
It was important for me to stay literal. I didn't want to be too inventive. And I wanted to be pretty. I wanted to be straightforward and just paint straightforward clothing on these people. And that would be enough combined with the actual narrative to provide for an impact on the children who are listening as their moms and dads are reading this to them. It's just all literal, concrete illustration. There's very little fudging around with the illustrations. I try and be as straightforward as I can, and still have it be, you know, each painting, I try to make it visually interesting and pretty and so forth. But I want to be literal. I want to be true to life.
For more information about He Is Risen Indeed, go to our website, issuesetc.org, or call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. Welcome back to Issues Etc. We're talking about religion and pop culture. Terry Mattingly is our guest. Terry, before we go back to our callers, you were responding to Norm's call from before the break where he was talking about the flow of music from the pop culture into the church, and you had a personal story.
Yeah, I grew up Southern Baptist, and in the final months of my father's life, my father was a Southern Baptist pastor, and he was suffering from Parkinson's disease, and that's ultimately what claimed his life a few years ago. Literally, one of the last times I saw my father, we took him to church on Sunday morning, and he had lost the ability to communicate at that point, but he could still sing. And I found it very moving that he could sit, you know, in a small Baptist, you know, or small worship service in the nursing home where he was, and still sing the words to all of these old hymns that he had known, you know, all of his life, and all the people around him had known all of his life. And what I thought about at the time is how many people growing up in our churches, you know, when I say our churches, I mean mainstream American churches today, how many of them are going to be singing songs that unite them over an 80-year life? How many of them are going to know the same songs that their children know, you know, that their grandchildren know? When music is turning over in most churches today, every couple of months. And it seemed to me that music is a very, very deep and emotional form of content that goes very deep into our subconscious and very deep into our memories. I don't know about many of your listeners, but I frequently have dreams that involve music. How is that possible if it literally isn't lasting more than a couple of months?
Hmm. Great point. Tammy's listening in Fayetteville, North Carolina on XM. Tammy, thanks for waiting and welcome to Issues Etc.
Hi.
Hi, Tammy.
Hi, how you doing?
Very well.
You want me to ask a question now?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Go ahead.
Okay. I'm driving through right here, and I've never called a radio station ever before. But your conversation was so interesting, and I'm going through a lot of things right now in my life, and I used to be very deep into church and everything, but my comment and question, or you can elaborate on it, is that I think people now today are more driven. Even myself have been involved in being driven toward emotional and like, you know, pastor this, pastor that, like the gentleman was saying, you know, it's more personality. It's more driven toward you're thinking about the pastor more than you're actually kind of like thinking about God, and your vision is driven by their vision, and you no longer really have the sense that, I mean, like, I feel that God gave me a vision myself, but somehow along the way, I felt like I got so fat, and I was doing what I was told to be doing and faithful, but I felt like I wasn't doing what God started me out to do.
Tammy, thanks for the call, and thanks for listening on XM down there in North Carolina. Let's deal with the whole issue she raised earlier there in her comment, having to do with the cult of personality that is the bread and butter of pop culture, and especially of celebrity culture, but now more and more of pop American Christianity, Terry.
Yeah, this is something that Dr. Haddon Robinson, the legendary professor of preaching, who most recently has been teaching at Gordon Conwell Theological Seminary up in Massachusetts, he was president of Denver Theological Seminary, when I taught there briefly. And Haddon thinks that, in a way, this kind of bare-your-soul cult of personality in the pulpit is one of the most subtle effects of popular culture on the modern church, which is that, in a sense, eventually we expect our pastors to communicate to us as if they were almost television talk show hosts. We expect them to address issues in emotional, personal, kind of confessional forms, because that is what we see in our pop culture.
So it's kind of the Oprahification of the pulpit.
Yeah. I've even joked around, it's kind of jokingly, I wrote an essay about this once, which is posted on my website in the freelance section at tmat.net. I even argued that I think you can watch the loss of the ability of American preachers to preach on difficult subjects like hell and damnation and the need, the urgent need for salvation. I think you can trace some of that to the development of microphone technology. That, you know, back when people used to do a lot of shouting in the pulpit, they had things they felt they needed to shout about. Well, all of a sudden you stick a microphone in every pulpit and everybody gets a whole lot softer and more nuanced.
And the subjects become more nuanced.
Yeah.
Let's talk with Tom in Modesto, California. He's listening on KFAX. Tom, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hi. Here's my question. You know, when I was growing up, our praise and worship was essentially out of a hymnal. Now we see no hymnal, essentially, and a lot of sort of choruses and some other, you know, sort of modern praise and worship type music. And I was wondering where you thought that was going. You know, the hymnals had a lot of theology in them. The stuff today doesn't have too much theology.
Thank you very much, Tom. Terry, your thoughts on this? I know that you had mentioned before that one of the big-ticket items a lot of churches are spending their money on is not 1,000 hymnals, but a 400-square-foot screen.
Yeah, large screen technology. Well, I mean, I already mentioned that one of the main, he asked, where is this all going? It seems to me that one of the main places it's going is that the music is turning over faster and faster. We've already talked about that. The other thing is that we live in a culture where our musical forms are getting more and more segmented as well. The hot word is niche. So, I mean, at some point, I think you begin to ask, at what point will our churches start turning into FM radio dials to where, you know, you go, you put your finger on the page in the church section of the yellow pages and scroll down, and it's like going down the FM dial from country church to pop church to hip-hop church to R&B church to NPR church to classical church.
My daughter listens to a lot of music. She's 14. And I've watched a transition from consuming her music off the radio, where someone else is picking the song list for her, to consuming her music off the internet, where she gets to pick the song list.
Right.
And I'm wondering how far away we go from the big screen to the little headphones where everybody gets to kind of iTunes their own personal music for Sunday morning that they can listen to on their private headphones, waiting for the pastor to get in the pulpit and preach.
I don't know, in large part because that would destroy the group emotion of the entire situation. There was a church that I covered out in Denver, a major evangelical Presbyterian church, that I thought it was very interesting that, you know, their church, this was a church that went from nothing to thousands of members in just a space of just a couple of years. And I asked the pastor if he could walk me through the statistics for the church. You know, and he talked about, you know, we had like, we started with a couple of hundred people, and then we had 1,000 people, and then boom, we went, you know, in the space of a few months from like 1,000 people attending to like 3,000 or 4,000 people attending. And I said, what happened, you know, during that year? What was the big change? And he kind of hemmed and hawed and was nervous about it a second. I kept coming back to it, and it was very apparent to him that I was going to keep asking the question until he answered. And he said, well, you know, we were doing the same type of music, but, well, we hired a drummer. And I said, you hired a drummer? And he said, yeah, it's amazing how much more emotional and unifying and cathartic your worship service is when you're dealing with people who've grown up in the rock and roll era, and all of a sudden you have a drummer. That's kind of scary.
Let's talk with Herman, who calls from Illinois. He listens on KSIV before we go to our break. Herman, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Thank you for taking my call. I'd like to ask your guest, Mr. Mattingly. I'll turn in on the public television network, and they have these popular music concerts, and you see people caught up in the music, kind of waving their arms in the air, swaying back and forth, and then you turn over to a Christian television network station, and you go to a contemporary service, and you see the same posture of waving hands and swaying, this kind of a sacrament of the waving hands. Is this sort of a transmigration of the spirituality between the secular and the church settings?
I'll tell you what, we're going to ask Terry to hold his answer until the other side of the break to Herman's call. Herman, thank you for listening there in Illinois. When we come back, we'll take more of your phone calls. We'll get Terry's answer to Herman's concern about the transmigration of one spirituality to the other. I mean, is it simply coincidence that you see exactly the same thing? And if you turn down the volume while watching either of those two things, could you tell the difference between the two? We're talking about religion and pop culture. Terry Mattingly is our guest. He's director of the Washington Journalism Center at the Council for Christian Colleges and Universities. He has authored the new book. I got one more to give away in the course of this hour. Pop Goes Religion, Faith in Popular Culture. He also authors the nationally syndicated On Religion column for the Scripps Howard News Service. Terry Mattingly is our guest. When we come back, an answer to Herman's question and more of your phone calls and your email here on Issues, Etc. You know, I don't know if you could tell the difference between the two if you turn the volume down. They look the same. Is it more than just a visual similarity? We'll get the answer after this. Pastor Scott Clems of Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, talking about the goals for the young men who attend Christ Academy 2006.
Christ Academy allows high school men to become a full, equal partner in the life of the seminary for 2 weeks every June. They attend chapel 4 times a day with the student body and faculty and staff. They go to classes for 3 or 4 hours a day, regular classes taught by the seminary faculty and staff. They become tight as a community and join together in prayer and greater understanding of Lutheran theology.
For more information about Christ Academy 2006 on the campus of Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, visit our website, issuesetc.org, or call Concordia Theological Seminary, 1-800-481-2155. That's issuesetc.org, or 1-800-481-2155.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Issues, Etc. relies on a small group of faithful supporters called the Issues, Etc. Reformation Club. These people have pledged to become monthly or annual contributors to Issues, Etc. This allows us to budget our expenses more efficiently. Now, there are three levels of giving. The confessor, $25 monthly or an annual gift of $250. The apologist, $50 monthly or an annual gift of $500. And the reformer, $100 monthly or an annual gift of $1,000. Now, each Reformation Club member receives premiums like monthly tapes, books, and transcripts. You can join the Issues Etc. Reformation Club today by making a gift payable to Issues Etc., Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. By credit card, our resource line number 1-800-737-0172 or online, issuesetc.org. The Issues Etc. Reformation Club. Welcome back to Issues, Etc. 10 more minutes with Terry Mattingly on religion and pop culture. We had a caller before the break, Herman, who was talking about at least the apparent similarity between what he called this sacrament of the waving hands. Terry, your thoughts on this?
Well, first of all, the actual Pentecostal, the birth of Pentecostal Christianity predates Woodstock, okay? So, I mean, so the whole idea that people put their hands in the air... This is also a gesture that's mentioned in, you know, Christian worship through all, you know, through the generations and centuries. So, I mean, to some degree, people have been putting their hands in the air for a long, long time. I mean, there's a couple of points in the liturgy in Eastern Orthodoxy, and you're dealing with liturgy from like the 6th to 10th century in which people put their hands in the air.
Sure.
So that's something that, you know, I wouldn't go overboard on that. At the same time, when people are emotionally involved in certain types of music, I wouldn't be at all surprised that they used similar body language and gestures.
So what does it tell us that, at least when it comes to kind of typical praise and worship experience and rock concert, the two have become, in many ways, indistinguishable from one another?
Yeah, I'll
is there more to it than just people involved in the music?
Well, no, for one thing, they have watched, you know, many, many hours of popular music and concerts and whatever, and you learn behavior through observing it. A lot of them have grown up going to rock concerts and stuff, so when the music is sounding very similar in another large, horizontal, flat hall, almost totally devoid of religious symbolism, we shouldn't be at all surprised that they act pretty much the same.
Here's Michael calling from Austin, Texas. He's listening on KIXL. Hi, Michael.
Hi. I just wanted to add, we used to go to a church that was very up and coming with the rock and roll and new modern worship. And as my health got bad, I was getting desperate to get close to God. And I found him in Romans 9 through his righteousness and his glory. And when our church taught it, they didn't teach it the way Paul talked about it. And I found that wherever we found churches where they were not teaching God's glory properly, they taught a man-centered message.
Michael, thank you very much for the call. Terry, what about the message of a pop American Christianity?
Well, he called it man-centered. I don't know exactly what he was saying there. But if you're trying to deny some sort of transcendent concept of eternal truth, what are you going to leave up? What are you going to come up with except something that could be called man-centered, where ultimately what people consume is what they want to consume and what they believe makes them feel right?
Don calls from California. Don, thank you very much for being patient. Welcome to Issues, Etc.
Sir, I want to thank you for your extremely balanced and informative program. One quick comment and then my question. As far as the FM church that's already happening with, you know, the family radio network, they're saying, you know, if you go to the church, you can't be saved and all that, and churches are dead. And I don't listen to it anymore, but apparently they're teaching us that they're the only my understanding is that, you know, don't go to church, but listen to family radio. But I don't listen to it anymore, so I'm not sure if I'm accurate, but I think I'm fairly accurate.
And then your question, Don?
Yes, sir. The question is, in California, there are a plethora, numerous seminars are aimed at businesses and professionals, and there are some of them are universalist in nature. They tell you that the universe is in you, guiding you to prosperity and solving your relational issues. And people say, well, they're scriptural principles, you know, they're Bible principles, but they're in a non-religious context, non-religious language, but there's no cross, no blood, no sin, no Savior. But people say, oh, they're user-friendly and everything. And can you please tell me if that's influencing the church?
Thank you very much, Don. It's a good question. He talks about these business seminars and the striking similarity between the average motivational speaker at one of these, which you might find in church. Terry?
Well, one of the things I am most interested in right now is to what degree the kind of morally watered down and universalistic messages of popular culture will to some degree flow into evangelicalism, and whether that will create a kind of church that grows. If you, it seems to me that this kind of all-tolerant Christianity works great for Oprah. It works great at the multiplex. But when you actually try to use it in churches, it fails. You know, for at least two generations, the more liberal the church theologically in American life, the more likely it is to be in decline statistically. But I'm willing at this point to say that one of the trends that I'm paying very close attention to is the growth of what could only be called an evangelical born-again left. Because, after all, if these churches are what the members vote that they want them to be, and the majority of Christians out there are soaking up this media uncritically, at some point they've got to take that to church with them.
We had a caller to our weekday program where we were talking about kind of the state of Sunday morning worship in a general way, and this lady called in and said she likened Sunday morning in some churches to what she said were religious Tupperware parties. What do you make of it, Terry?
Well, I don't know exactly what she's talking about. She could be referring to, you know, to the whole trend toward very emotional and highly personal small group meetings.
She was also talking about the sense that you're being sold something at every point, not either an idea or something, but it was a very kind of the sales context.
Hardly anybody is making any demands on you. They're basically kind of like focus grouping the worship service and putting all the stuff in it that attract the listeners. Well, I could see that.
David calls from St. Louis, and David listens on KSIV here in St. Louis. David, welcome.
Thank you. My question is, what you're talking about, doesn't it specifically relate to 2 Timothy 4:3 of having itching ears and choosing leaders unto themselves, chasing after their own lusts, and Romans 12:2, where it talks about being conformed to this present world, but be transformed.
David, thank you very much. Terry, your thoughts on the two passages that David mentioned?
Yes and yes. Yeah, I think he nailed it.
So then how do Christians engage? We've talked so much about the similarities between pop culture and the culture that Christians find themselves in church. How do Christians rightly engage the culture such as we have it?
Well, this may be a radical idea for some of your listeners, but I think the best thing that Christians can do is try to actually engage the popular culture by working in the popular culture. I would be a lot more interested if there were more young Christians out there who were interested in actually making popular music that would sell in the real music stores, play on the real radio stations, and then they would take their Christian faith with them into their careers on real stages instead of trying to turn Sunday morning into a rock concert.
You're talking about what Luther would have referred to as living the Christian life in one's vocation.
Yeah, I mean, but to some degree, I don't understand the motivation. Why why are so many young Christians so anxious to turn church into a nightclub? I mean, when essentially they seem to be scared of trying to compete in the real world of popular music with their Christian faith latent, which, you know, which brings us back to that famous C.S. Lewis quote, that the world doesn't need more Christian writers, the world needs more Christians who are willing to pay the price to be writers for everyone.
Two Lewis quotes, one at the beginning, one at the end. You've met your contractual obligations, Terry. Thank you very much for being our guest.
Well, glad to be here.
Terry Mattingly is author of the nationally syndicated On Religion column for Scripps Howard News Service. He's director of the Washington Journalism Center at the Council for Christian Colleges and Universities and author of the new book, Pop Goes Religion, Faith in Popular Culture. I'm going to give the second copy of that to Don, our earlier caller. Give us a call back, 1-800-730-2727, and I'll send you a copy of that book, Pop Goes Religion. 1-800-737-0172 is the phone number for our resource line. You can use that number to request a free complimentary copy of our Next Issues Etc. journal, or you can use that number to join our monthly donor program. It's the Issues Etc. Reformation Club. 1-800-737-0172, or write us at Issues Etc., Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117, Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. It's quite true. Lewis was dead right. We don't need Christian writers. We need Christians who are engaged in the culture, be it writing or making their music, who are carrying the Christian faith that the church bestows upon them in its preaching, this Christ-centered, cross-focused faith, out into the world, serving their neighbor in love, in their various vocations. We might even say unselfconsciously Christian in this very spiritual pop culture. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen each week to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can donate by credit card on our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. For a free audio copy of this hour of Issues Etc., please visit the audio archive section at kfuo.org. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of Worldwide KFUO. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.